Hello, everybody. I'm Martin Grant again, the Dean of Science. Welcome to the second lecture of Mini Science 2009, To Infinity and Beyond. Before we get going, I'd like to share a dream with everyone. It's not my dream for, great success in the faculty or a dream for great philanthropic success with fundraising. It's a dream my wife had last night where she dreamed that I went on and on and on at the beginning of this talk, and I've assured her this will be one dream that is not realized. Not all dreams come true. Last week, Vicky Caspi gave a lecture on neutron stars, and if you weren't there last week, here's some of what you missed: how a neutron star is born out of the remnants of a supernova explosion, and the significance of studying neutron stars as they spin around, the discovery of pulsar stars by Cambridge PhD student Jocelyn Bell and her supervisor, and the discovery of the fastest rotating known neutron star, which is the F-sharp above the high E on a guitar on the 12th string. I would whistle it, but I will not try to do that, by a team led by Vicky's grad student, Jason Hessels. On the McGill.ca science, mini-science website, there's answers to some questions that I didn't get to last week. They are, why is the speed of light the speed limit? What happens to neutrons, protons, and gluons in a neutron star? Are quarks just free? And since neutrons have no charge, does star rotation generate... Since neutrons have no charge, how come a star rotation can generate a magnetic field? There's a bunch of electrons there. That's why. And now, it being a science event... Yeah, Matt, you're in for it. And now, since it's a science event, we have... skill testing questions for everyone here, and it gives me notes here of what I should say, but I'll just go ahead. I can't believe some of these questions. These are Vicky's questions, actually. So here's the first question. It's not a competition. There's no wagering. Thank everyone. What rotates faster, the fastest known millisecond pulsar or your kitchen blender? Yes. A right answer. Looks like you and McGill physics in approximately 6 or 7 years, like your mom was 6 or 7 years ago. Now they upgrade a little bit. I know people have been lying in wait to show they were really listening last week. So some stars, actually I have the answers here, so I should cover it up with Matt's talk. Some stars like Cepheids, about which we'll hear more in Professor Rutledge's lecture. Bob Rutledge, I think, is on in 3 weeks' time. They pulsate because their radii get larger and smaller, with the entire surface of the star getting brighter or dimmer as it pulsates out and in, out and in. Is this why pulsars, that is neutron stars, seem to pulsate? I heard it a couple of no's. Why is that? Because they rotate. Yeah, I told Vicky is a tough crowd. We're not going to catch them so easily. So this one has an answer which is about, how can I guess my wife's dream is coming true, you know. How can finding even faster millisecond pulsars assist in our efforts to understand matter at extremely high densities? I can't quite hear you. What's that? That's actually pretty much what Vicky wrote, yeah. Let me read what she wrote. Different models for different behaviors of matter at ultra-high densities or different equations of state predict different maximum rotation speeds for neutron stars is because, depending on the behavior of the matter in the stellar interior, the star can be more or less compact with the same mass. A very fast rotating star that's less compact will not be able to hold itself together as easily as a more compact star. Yeah, I kind of agree. Okay, at the end of tonight's lecture, We'll ask you to write down questions. There are scores are not being kept and grades are not given, but extra points are available for those who write legibly, because I have to read them. If we don't get them to them all, refer to some of the questions to Professor Dobbs, and we'll post them on the website. And please fill out the evaluation form at the end so we get some idea of how we're doing. And please turn off as well my cell phone. Today's speaker is Matt Dobbs. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Physics who conducts research on the fundamental constituents of the universe and the early universe. He is a Canada Research Chair in Astroparticle Physics. He's only been here a few years, but he heads the McGill Cosmology Instrumentation Laboratory, which designs and builds new instrumentation for observational cosmology. They deploy and operate their instruments in some of the most adventurous locations of the globe, from the geographic South Pole, Antarctica, to the top of the stratosphere. Their mission is to make measurements that will help us better understand what the universe is made of, how it came to be, and how it will evolve. Matt had obtained his PhD in 2002, not in astronomy, but experimental particle physics from the University of Victoria, and then went to Lawrence Livermore, is that right?
Lawrence Berkeley,
as a member of the ATLAS collaboration at CERN in Switzerland. He came here in 2006 and has been in the news talking about the South Pole Telescope, the largest ever telescope built and operated at the South Pole, which is used to probe the lingering light and energy of the Big Bang. You can read more about Matt in the enclosed packages with his biography. Matt, you're on.
Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction, but also thank you, Carolyn, for encouraging Martin to remain brief. Okay, let's get these slides up. Ooh, there's multiple levels of this. Okay, welcome to the next edition of Mini Science. My job today is to tell you a little bit about cosmology, and I'm going to focus on observational cosmology, the thing that I spend most of my time on. How many people here are researchers of some sort? Maybe your job is to build new knowledge. You might be a scientist. Maybe you're a detective. Maybe you're some other form of researcher. Are there a few people here? Researchers? Great. How many people are builders? How many people build or fix things? You might be a carpenter. You might be a fixer. You might be a dentist. You might be a doctor. You might be an experimentalist. Okay, so I'm getting about a quarter of the people. And how many people are teachers of some form? So you might be a teacher in front of a classroom. You might be a mentor at work, helping young people to grow into your shoes. Are there a few people here that are teachers of some form? Great. So the goal of what I spend most of my time doing is bringing these three things together and using them and the people who are my mentorees and who are my colleagues to bring those people together to make new measurements about the origin, the fate, and the history of the universe. And what I'm going to try and do today is share a little bit about the science of this field, but also as much as I can about the adventure of doing science in this field. And one of the things that hopefully we'll have fun with is experiencing that adventure a little bit. So the main goal here as an experimentalist, as an observational cosmologist for me, is to learn about these theories that other people are building, are putting together, explanations for how we got to where we are in the universe, and essentially hold court on them. Other people put forth ideas about how the universe was born, how it's evolving, and they make predictions about what we'll see on the night sky, what we'll see in the universe, and we go out and build the things that measure those predictions and kill a lot of the theories and support some precious few that seem to be on the right track. So let's explore a few of those theories today and see where we might be a few years from now in terms of killing theories. Compressed in this slide is the entire history of the universe. We have 13.7 billion years of information here, and it's not drawn to scale, obviously. Our goal in cosmology is to understand this history of the universe on the largest scales. So here at the beginning, we have something that is Big Bang-like. We have an expansion that happens afterwards. We have the emission of the cosmic microwave background, which is the focus of this talk. I'll explain that a lot more. Eventually, we have the creation of stars, galaxies, and the structure in the universe. And then we move forward through an expansion phase in the universe. Well, throughout this is expansion, to eventually get to where we are today, sitting here as we are with the South Pole Telescope on planet Earth, looking back at the structures that have formed in the universe. One of the theories that we're going to talk a little bit about today is this brief instant of time right after the Big Bang, if indeed the Big Bang is the right description for the birth of the universe, called inflation. Inflation is this brief instant of time right after the singularity, which is the Big Bang, when the universe unfolds and expands very, very rapidly, faster than the speed of light. And I'll be going into more detail on that as we work through the night. Just to give you some background, if the judge in science, if the scientific method was a democracy, inflation would be the theory that we had today. This is where most scientists, the majority of scientists, think we're on the right track so far. We have not, of course, proven inflation. There's no scientific theory we've proven. But inflation has made some fantastic predictions that I'll show you tonight, and so far has withstood the test of observation. What we'd like to do, most of the goal of what I'm going to show you today, is going after more predictions of inflation or other competing theories and trying to see if these theories are on the right track for explaining the universe in which we live. Okay, so let's walk outside and look up at the night sky. When we look up at the night sky, we see beautiful structure. We see structure like these two colliding galaxies. We see molecular clouds lit up by neighboring stars, like the image from the Kitt Peak telescope on your far right. And things like planets that have moons orbiting them. These aren't cosmological scales. Let's step back to much larger scales and look up at the night sky. And we might see something on much larger scales that's much, much more uniform. The image that you see here is a photograph of the night sky. It is a projection of the entire night sky folded out onto a flat piece of paper, much like we take the projection of the Earth and fold that out flat to make a map. And this is a very, very high precision measurement of the night sky at the wavelength where most of the light on the night sky exists, the millimeter wavelength. And you can see it's a very uniform, boring, same everywhere place. So if we take, having recorded this image of the night sky, if we ask ourselves the question, where are we in the universe? Well, the answer is nowhere special. We're kind of in a place like any other in this image of the night sky. If instead of measuring the night sky spatially, looking at different directions, we measure the intensity of light, how much light is coming at each different wavelength, we see that the peak wavelength is at about a millimeter. Okay, so the wavelength is across the top. This is in centimeters, and 1 millimeter is right here. And the spectrum of this light follows a black body spectrum. It is the same spectrum you would get, or you do get, if you turn on your oven and look inside and see the red glowing. That red glowing is emitting light at many different wavelengths, and the shape of that light as a function of wavelength looks like this black body spectrum. We believe what we're seeing with this light is the oven that is the universe at a period about 300 to 400,000 years after the Big Bang glowing at these wavelengths. The majority of all the photons in the universe are at these longer wavelengths than what we're used to looking at with optical light. Light like what we look at with the Hubble Space Telescope. Light that's hundreds of nanometers long. We can also look out at the night sky with much larger wavelengths, like radio waves, the same wavelengths that our car antenna picks up. Okay? And this light sits right in between that. It's about a millimeter in wavelength, and it sits between the optical, much shorter wavelengths, and radio waves at much longer wavelengths. So When we look up at the sky and measure the spectrum, we see something that looks like a black body glowing. And what we're looking at is the universe glowing from a very ancient time. Now, when I show you this map of the night sky, this is a very important map of the night sky. It was brought down by the COBE satellite in 1992. This image, which looks like I may have been able to make it with a PowerPoint blob or a pen and piece of paper, cost many hundreds of millions of dollars. And it is profoundly exciting and interesting. Since you have to write your questions down and have Dean Grant ask them to me later, let me ask a question, even though it's my talk. What is going on here? And then what I'm doing is I'm looking out at the universe, and I'm looking out, I can look a distance equivalent to the age of the universe, 14 billion years, times the speed of light, how long it takes light to travel. I can look out in this direction, 14 billion light years, and what I see is red, which corresponds to intensity of light or a temperature, and that temperature is about 3 degrees Kelvin. When I turn around the other way and look 14 billion light years in that direction, I see the same temperature. This information from over here is just now arriving to me today. I'm just now looking at a part of the universe that became visible when the universe became a little bit older so that I could see further. The same thing is happening in the other direction. I'm just now receiving information from that edge of the universe. How did these two states, these two areas of the universe, know to come in agreement and be at the same temperature? How did they talk to each other? This, in cosmology, is referred to as the horizon problem. We see structures, we see coherence, we see lightness on scales that are so big that we need some way to explain how they were ever able to talk to each other and achieve consensus and agree to be at the same temperature. Otherwise, you might expect to see something random over here and randomly different over there. Instead, we see in every direction, no matter how far we look, the same temperature, an isotropic universe. So this is one of the first things that we're going to have to explain with our theories. Okay, the concept of light taking time to reach us. I think you probably visited that last lecture as well. But it's a very, very, very important concept in astronomy. So let's just make sure that we have that cemented in. I'm looking at rows and rows and rows of people. And in the front row, I'm looking at people as they were about 50 nanoseconds ago. So these people are glowing, naturally. And the light that I'm looking at, that I'm registering their images with, took about 50 nanoseconds to get from here to here. So I'm looking at their image to me as younger than they are now. When I look at the row behind, I'm looking at people this instant that are 60 nanoseconds younger than they are now when that light arrives to me, and so forth and so on. If this whole row gave me a whole cross-section of the human species, and this row did the same, and so forth and so on, and the distance that you were away from me was far enough, if the Earth was big enough, I might be able to test the model of human evolution. If the Earth was so big that I could look at people as they were 10,000 years ago, I would be able to look at a cross-section of the human population as it was 10,000 years ago. And by looking at a closer and closer and closer row, I might be able to piece together what I thought was the evolution of the human species. I want to do the very same thing with stars, planets, galaxies, and the universe. And that's exactly what I'm going to be doing through this talk. I'm going to look at things that are close by to see the universe as it is now. I'm going to look at things that are kind of far away as to see the universe as it was as a teenager. And I'm going to look at things that are very far away to look at the universe when it was very young. Okay, so let's take our hundreds of million dollars of satellite and measure this really well. And what you're seeing here is the average signal across the sky. Let's measure that really well and subtract it away and see what sits below it. There's a little deviation in this signal, which you can't make out in this color scale, and you can make out on the right-hand scale. And what this is, this dipole, is a little bit of a warm spot in this direction and a cold spot over here in this direction. This is our motion, the motion of the Earth around the sun through the galaxy, and our galaxy moving through the cosmos with respect to this background light. It's a Doppler shift of our motion. Okay? And it tells us something about us, but it doesn't tell me too much about the rest of the universe. So I'm going to measure that really well and fit it out to what a Doppler shift would look like, this structure, and look at what sits below. And what I see sitting just below this, if I subtract this away, then subtract that away, is little spots in the universe. And this big red streak across the middle is just trouble for me. It's the galaxy, the Milky Way, which I wish I was seeing right through and isn't quite transparent. About 10 years later, a different satellite called the WMAP satellite flew, and it recorded this very, very high fidelity image of the same thing. The difference between these two images is just that that's better technology, a better satellite. Okay, so this image is fuzzy. We aren't able to see as fine structures, and we weren't able to understand the galaxy as well to subtract it away. This is the image. This is the higher fidelity image of the universe, and this is the next thing that your theory is going to have to be able to predict. The universe has spots. Okay, it has spots in the bottom right-hand corner, and it has spots at very specific scales. And those spots look relatively random everywhere. And it turns out that before either of these space missions were flown, there was a prediction for this. There was a very powerful prediction for this, and it came from the inflationary model. What inflation told us, or what the folks that put together inflation explained, is that quantum mechanics, creations and annihilations that are taking place all around us on tiny macroscopic scales. If space-time, if the universe is allowed to inflate, to suddenly get to a much bigger size, those quantum mechanical creations and annihilations, which normally don't show up on large scales, they can get stretched out to cosmic scales and form structure like this in the universe. Tiny structure. This is deviations in intensity of light, that's about one part in 100,000. That's a hard prediction. That's a hard observation to fake. That's a strong test of a model, and one of the reasons that we're so excited about inflation amongst other theories. Furthermore, it predicts how these little overdensities and underdensities, hot spots and cold spots in the early universe, can evolve through time to the expansion history of the universe and eventually collapse under the force of gravity to form that beautiful structure that I showed you in the previous slides, to form galaxies and galaxy clusters and stars and so forth. So one of the reasons that we're after a theory like this is that it provides an explanation for why it provided a prediction that the universe would have spots and that those spots would help us explain why we have structure in the universe, would help us get to where we are now with structure in the universe. Okay. Let's move forward then and come back to our slide of observational cosmology. And now we can understand a little bit better what we're looking at when we sit here on the bottom of the planet and look back through time, because the further and further away we're looking at older and older objects. So as we look back, as we look out through the cosmos, we are looking back through time. And eventually we look back to this surface, which is the microwave background I just showed you. And what's happening there in our Big Bang-like models is that the very early universe was a very homogeneous isotropic space, like that red blob I showed you. There are very few differences across the universe. Inflation, by blowing up the scale of quantum fluctuations to cosmic scales, created little differences here and there. At that time, very early in the history of the universe, matter, like electrons, protons, and so forth, had not yet bound together to form chemistry. So, for example, hydrogen is just a proton with an electron orbiting around. And if you heat up hydrogen with enough energy, it will break apart. There was so much energy in the universe at that time that it was impossible for protons to stay married to electrons. And so early on, if the universe expanded like this, there was so much energy density around the universe that you couldn't have chemistry yet, and you had separate protons and electrons. Since light is is the propagator of the electromagnetic force, it's absorbed by protons and electrons. It's absorbed by anything that has charge. So the early universe, back here, would be completely opaque to light. I wouldn't be able to see you or any of these rows before this time. As the universe expands and cools, it's expanding, and so its energy, which is constant, is being shared by a larger and larger volume, so it's getting to a lower temperature. As the universe expands and cools, it eventually becomes a place where chemistry can exist, where hydrogen can bind together to form neutral particles. And it turns out that that happens relatively rapidly. And as soon as that happens, the universe becomes transparent. I can now see across the universe. I can see the rows of people and start to learn about the evolution of the universe. So this surface back here, in this history of the universe, is as far as we're able to see. If indeed the universe started as a very hot, dense place, there's no way we can see beyond this surface with light. So part of the adventure I'm going to take you on today is an adventure in mapping and understanding this surface of last scattering, this leftover light from the Big Bang, so that we have many observations of the universe out here, so that we have a lever arm, a place way out in the very early universe where we can ground our theories, where we can anchor our theories. And we have to insist that anyone that comes up with a cosmological model, anyone who tries to explain the universe we live in, their theory has to predict what we see today, and it has to predict these conditions that existed about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. So that's where we're going with this. Okay, I'm going to skip that part. One of the other problems we have in cosmology, and this is a harder concept. One of the other problems we have in cosmology is that in space-time, we're able to see through straight lines. I look out across the room, and I'm able to see straight to you. That's on scales of many meters. That is also seems to be true when we look across the cosmos. It happens to be that when we look out to the Andromeda galaxy, or we look back to the microwave background light left over after the Big Bang, we appear to be looking in straight lines. That doesn't have to be the case at all. The mathematics that define space-time also allow us to have a structure that is open like this, where if we looked out what looked like straight lines, our lines would diverge like that. And things that we see would actually be much bigger than they appear. Because I think I'm looking out here and here, but actually the light would be bending out this way. We could also have a structure of space-time that is closed. So if I look out in this direction, the light would actually bend back around. And so something very small would be apparently very big to me if it's at a great distance. So this observation that our universe happens to have flat space-time is another thing that our theories are going to have to confront. And it turns out that in a universe that is expanding, that is getting bigger, it's really, really hard to do that with the mathematics. Indeed, if you start with a universe which is almost flat, so the number one here in this parameter represents a flat universe, and you evolve it forward in your theory, allowing it to grow and expand, it moves away from being flat just through the mathematics. And so we need some way in our theory to also address this thing, which is called the flatness problem. So whatever theory, if you happen to be a home theorist and you want to attack the history of the universe, there are many things that you have to address, but you better address that the universe has flat space-time. We see in straight lines. You better address that the universe is the same in all directions. It's isotropic and homogeneous. And you better address that the universe does have little spots at about one part in 100,000. And we will see a model that does exactly that. So these are all questions that your theory has to address. Let's move now to measure what the universe looks like. And let's take our journey now to the South Pole, to the geographic South Pole, to the Amundsen Scott Research Station, where we've been building and operating the South Pole telescope. The group that's built this telescope is a collaboration of about eight or nine academic institutions. The lead comes from the University of Chicago. We also have University of California, Berkeley, UC Davis, University of Colorado Boulder, Cardiff University, Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, Case Western Reserve University and the University of Illinois. McGill is the only Canadian partner in this collaboration. And this motley crew of people that you see here is the crew that went out and deployed and built the telescope in the first season about 2.5 years ago. And if you look closely at the faces there, you'll see a broad spectrum of ages and so forth, because the engine that is driving this telescope, this science, are young people, graduate students, that are learning the science, learning the technology, and doing these new measurements. So let's go back about 2.5 years and move to 90 degrees south and look at the telescope as it's being constructed. This is one of the earlier shots of the construction of the telescope. We see one of the booms in place rising up and the support structure of the primary dish. Take this for a sense of scale, and what you see down here, this door is, well, this is a door, so that's about the size of a person. So this is a very large object. And every part of this object has to fit inside airplanes. This is the biggest airplane it gets to fit in, and make this journey to the South Pole. So how do we get to the South Pole? For this project, the way we get there is we first fly to New Zealand, where the United States Polar Programs has a facility set up that provides us with training and extreme cold weather gear. We then board a military transport aircraft, shown here, and make the flight about 4 hours on this jet to the coast of Antarctica. And inside this aircraft, it's equipped very nicely for people. About the front half, the plane is really shaking, so it's hard to take a high-resolution image. About half of it is equipped for people. About half of it is for equipment and telescope parts and so forth. From there, we land on the coast, and we get on board these Delta tractors. We land on the ocean itself, on frozen ice on the ocean, and then move on to land to McMurdo Station. This is the hub for research activity in Antarctica, and you can see the line of a Russian icebreaker that is coming in here to drop and bring supplies. So the parts of the telescope come in on boats through this channel that's broken up by the icebreaker. From there, we board these relatively small C-130 propeller aircraft. And inside the size of it, to give you a sense of scale, the main hull of the aircraft looks something like this. There's a row of people on each side, our extreme cold weather gear and other supplies in the middle. And then every bit of that large telescope needs to break down into small enough pieces in order to fit into the cargo hold of this aircraft. It was about 120 flights aboard these propeller planes to bring the South Pole telescope to the geographic South Pole. As you approach the geographic South Pole by air, it looks something like this. This is an old research station, which is no longer in heavy operation, and the new station is being built in this photograph. The new station houses about 260 people in the polar summer. So there's about 260 individuals that live inside this building, do science there, and then support the scientists that are working there. A view coming off the plane. Why are we taking this big, huge telescope to the South Pole anyway? It seems like a little bit of trouble to get down there, and indeed it is. The South Pole is one of the driest places on Earth. It is a desert, drier than the Sahara Desert. And the wavelengths of light that we're interested in, about a millimeter, are not transmitted well through water vapor. So if we could, we would be like that satellite that I showed you data from. We'd be above the atmosphere and look directly out at the cosmos. But it's really hard to get an object of this size into space. So instead, we would like to be somewhere that's high and dry. We'd like to be in a desert on the top of a mountain. The geographic South Pole is almost the top of a mountain. This station is sitting on 2.5 kilometers of glacial ice. And that ice is sitting on 0.5 kilometer of dirt and rock. So the altitude that we're at here is similar to the altitude of many of the higher peaks in the Canadian Rockies. We're not used to thinking that when we think of the South Pole, but it's a very high place. In addition, the atmosphere around the Earth is shaped a little bit like a pancake, and so it's thinner there than it is at the equator. It's also kind of nice if you're an astronomer to have just one day and one night per year. And indeed, that's exactly what we have. The sun sets once. around, and then it rises again in spring. Not everyone gets to stay in the new fancy station. This is where I stayed, a James Way hut next to the station. It is heated, though, heated with jet fuel. And this side room off the side is where the furnaces are to heat it. Things tend to be a little bit overheated down there, and so it's really nice to have this tent structure where you can just open a little hole and get some fresh air. The station sits about a kilometer and a half away from the location that we chose to build the South Pole Telescope in. This telescope is very sensitive to radio interference and just anything else that's going on. So we built it over here in what's called the dark sector, where you're not allowed to operate walkie-talkies and other radio interference devices. So each day we would walk about a kilometer and a half out across the glacier, across the airfield, to the location of the South Pole Telescope. Here's two graduate students and a postdoc putting together the main reflector or primary of the telescope. The primary mirror of this telescope is about 10 meters, about 3 stories tall, or it is 10 meters, 3 stories tall, and the flatness, the accuracy to which each one of these panels is mated together is about 4 parts per million. So it's a very accurate surface. And what's shown here is just the understructure. There's actually panels that sit on top of these. And these devices here hold up the panels. The primary dish itself is a big object, and it takes 2 large cranes to lift it up onto the telescope support structure, which you're seeing in this photograph. And then eventually we have a mechanical telescope that is there to go after our science. This picture is a picture of the telescope itself, and most of the people in the picture, there's some scientists there, most of them are the iron workers, electricians, and carpenters that helped us put this telescope together. So a large number of specialties and influences go into building this. A photograph of the lab next to the telescope. Okay. So I think we've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves, though, because I've introduced the microwave background to you. I've shown you the great information we've been able to glean about the isotropy of the universe, that it's the same in each direction, the spots that it has that have been predicted by at least one class of theories, and the flatness problem and so forth. But I haven't told you what this telescope does that's special, what this telescope is going to measure that we don't already know from the images I showed you. And our goal with this telescope is to measure something that was predicted in 1971 by a pair of Russian theorists, Saneyev and Zeldovich, called the Saneyev-Zeldovich effect. And so far, I've described to you, looking back from where we are today through cosmic time at this surface of last scattering at the microwave background, as if there was nothing sitting between us in that very early time. Photons interact with anything that's charged, electrons, positrons, and so forth. And in the universe, we have big areas that are just full of charges. One such area are galaxy clusters. So remember, we have stars, like our own sun, and you take many stars together and you get a galaxy, like the Milky Way. And if you have a collection of galaxies that are gravitationally bound together, you have a galaxy cluster, the largest collapsed gravitationally bound objects in the universe, I think. It turns out that these galaxy clusters, they have galaxies in them that are orbiting around, but most of what's in a galaxy cluster is gas and what's called dark matter, which I'll describe a little bit later. But isn't the galaxies themselves, it's gas that's sitting at the center. And a lot of that gas is free electrons and free protons. So when light tries to get through a galaxy cluster, some of that light can interact with that charged gas, that plasma. And it turns out that the plasma inside the galaxy cluster is hotter than the microwave background, has more energy. So what happens is our beautiful black body curve, that Planck spectrum that I showed you measurements of earlier, gets distorted. It gets pushed up to higher energy, to higher frequency, because it takes up some energy from the galaxy cluster. It takes up a little bit of the galaxy cluster's energy, and it distorts the spectrum. Let's pretend that we have a telescope which is only sensitive to light right here, right at the peak. As I look around the universe, I'm going to see the same temperature, the same intensity of light in every direction. Until, bang, I'm looking through a galaxy cluster, and there, Some of the photons that would normally be at this energy have been kicked up to a higher energy and have disappeared if my telescope's only able to see this wavelength. So I'm going to be looking around and see that normal red blob everywhere, and I'm going to look through a galaxy cluster and see a hole in the sky, a place with fewer photons, fewer microwave background photons. And that's exactly the signature we're after with this. Now, the typical size of a galaxy cluster is about an, as it appears to us, is about an arc minute on the sky. So the moon is about a degree, and the spots that you saw earlier were about a degree on the night sky. And so if you want to see something that's a degree big on the night sky, you just need a little telescope. If you want to see something have the angular resolution, the fidelity to see a small object on the night sky, you need a really big telescope. And so this telescope is different from the previous ones, and then it's big enough to look directly at a galaxy cluster that appears small, and see this effect. That's why the telescope has to be so big. It's so big so we can't fly it in space, and so the best place to put it for this telescope is at the South Pole. Why do we care so much about seeing galaxy clusters this way? Well, what we're doing when we see a galaxy cluster this way is we're looking at light that's all over the universe behind the galaxy cluster. We're not looking at light that comes from the galaxy cluster itself. Other means of seeing stuff in the sky, optical observations, X-ray observations, other telescopes, look at light that's shining in the star. And just like if you took a light bulb and you ran it up Mount Royal, as you ran it further and further and further away up Mount Royal, it would get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. Because you're sharing those photons you're seeing with more and more people at the same radius. It drops off as 1 over r squared. The same thing happens if you take a galaxy or a star and you move it further and further away. It gets harder and harder to see. But the light we're looking at these galaxy clusters with is all at the same distance. It's all behind the galaxy clusters, and it's backlighting them like shadow puppets. So with this technique, looking for these holes in the sky, these missing photons, we're able to see galaxy clusters no matter how far away they are. And as someone who's interested in the expansion history of the universe, the history of how the universe evolved, I want to be able to see things at any distance, at any age, with an equal signal. So I'm not confused by the change in brightness because it's further away, or maybe it changed in brightness because it's older, and so forth. So we're really excited about this technique because it tells us about something in the universe that traces the history of the universe. And it does so in a way that doesn't depend on how far away those objects are. So we like it because galaxy clusters can be seen out to any distance. And this is new. Okay, let's pause for a minute and look at something else that probably you've been introduced to in the popular media or in science reading. This is the energy composition of the universe in a pie chart. And this stuff up here in colors is the usual stuff you're used to. This is planets, stars, and galaxies, people, other things that are made of regular matter. There's also this bit of stuff out here that we call dark matter. And we know a lot about dark matter because we're able to see it indirectly through its gravitational attraction. So we know that the universe is about 30%, very roughly, of dark matter. And we can go out and measure that dark matter in the universe by looking at, for example, the orbits of the spinning of galaxies and orbits of stars within galaxies. There's this other bit of the energy density of the universe which came as a big surprise. About 10 years ago, there was a group of, well, two groups of scientists that were measuring exploding stars, supernova, and they were figuring out how far away the stars were by how much the light had dimmed as it traveled here. Just the thing I was talking about before, the dimming because it's further away. Simultaneously, they could measure the expansion of the universe over that time period because they could see how much the light had been stretched out, the wavelength of the light had been stretched out by the expansion of the universe. So check that out, the expansion of the universe, the expansion of space-time. When space-time expands, wavelengths like light expand. And everything, if the universe is expanding, anything that's not that would be apparently still would be moving away from you. So take, for example, this gentleman sitting in this seat. If he were to look out all around him at this space-time, he would see that stuff is spaced by about 1.5 feet, the distance between the seats. If I took this room and expanded the space-time, so that each seat was now 3 feet away. He would see that this person 2 seats away from him has moved a little bit further away. But he'd see that Dean Grant over here had moved a great distance away because this person started twice as far away. The expansion of the universe, the expansion of space-time. So they measured this expansion of the universe over the time that the light had traveled from the exploding star by measuring the stretching of the wavelength of light. And what they found is that the only way they could explain what they were seeing is if the universe wasn't just expanding, but it was accelerating in its expansion. The expansion of the universe is speeding up today. This was not what they expected to find. They expected with all that stuff out there in the universe that's gravitationally attracting, they would see it slowing down. They found that the universe is accelerating. And so we don't really know what to do with this, so we just call it dark energy. And if we have to count up all the energy we need to account for these observations, we need about 70% of all the energy in the universe to be of this dark energy form. And I wish I could tell you more, but I can't, because we don't know yet. So recently I was at a conference and we were trying to enumerate all the really well-motivated models of dark energy where, you know, someone would say, oh, it could be this, and everyone in the room would go, oh, yeah, we don't have a reason why it wouldn't be that. And, well, this is what we came up with. Any questions? Yeah, so we'd like to learn a lot more. Any tool we have to understand this recent accelerated expansion, we want to use. And maybe we'll find that little tidbit of information that's going to tip us off as to why this is going on. There is a mathematical loophole that we can do it with inside Einstein's general relativity. So it could just be a trick of math. But many of us don't like that because it's a trick of math that we have to put very, very specific numbers into. And we wish we could predict those numbers instead of having them fine too. Okay, so we would like to measure galaxy clusters all over the universe at different redshifts. And think of redshift down here on the x-axis is at different ages of the universe. This is the very early universe. This is the teenager universe. This is the adult universe. And this is the today old age universe. And it turns out that the growth of structure, the creation of galaxy clusters, depends very, very strongly on how fast the universe is expanding, whether it's accelerating in its expansion or not, and how it's accelerating in its expansion. Because you can imagine if you're trying to take galaxy clusters and pull them together into collapsed structures, you're going to be fighting against this thing that's accelerating the expansion. And it probes this expansion at a different time. Okay, so it probes it at a redshift of about 2, which is several billion years ago. And other measurements that we have probe it at different times. So this is one of the main reasons that we're after these galaxy clusters, so that we can use them to look at how the universe evolved over time. And we can plug them into our theories and predict how many there should be at different ages in the history of the universe. Dark energy captures the public attention all the time. There's articles all over the place, including our own Quebec Science. And so if you want to go back to the June 2007, there's an article in French about dark energy and about the South Pole Telescope, just to bring it closer to home. Actually, in the interest of time, what I had planned to do was to tell you a little bit more about the technology that makes these measurements possible. And I think I'm going to skip over that a little bit, except just to give you the punchline. I'll flip through the photos as I give you the punchline. This instrument that we've been building at the South Pole, we built over the last couple years because we couldn't do it before. We didn't know how to build detectors that would see this millimeter wavelength light with the precision that we needed to make this measurement, with the accuracy we needed to make this measurement. This camera that we built, which uses detectors like the ones that are shown in this plot, uses superconducting electronics, which are operating at a fraction of a degree Kelvin, so at minus 273 degrees Celsius, to detect the heat that's imparted from these photons. There's about 1,000 of these detectors inside the focal plane of the South Pole Telescope. And we read out the signals. We're able to sense what these detectors are seeing by using other superconducting devices that use quantum interference to measure what's happening inside the detectors. So the reason that we're doing these measurements now, the theory for this was known back in the 70s. The reason we're doing these measurements today is because we finally can. We finally have the technology to drive these measurements to go after this type of science. And so that's a big part of what we do here at McGill and what our partners in this telescope do, is make that technology that allows these measurements to take place, make that technology amenable to telescopes like this and projects like this so that we can bring back our science results. And I'm just flipping through some of the images of the camera and the inside guts of the telescope coming together. Okay, so the conclusion there, or the thing I want you to take home, really, isn't that we have some bright new idea to go measure something we didn't think of before. It's that finally we can make those measurements today. At the South Pole, it's not just guys out there. These are some of the girls of the South Pole, the women of the South Pole. And you might wonder why they're all outside standing around the barber pole that marks the South Pole. Well, that's obvious. It's because there's guys like this inside, our graduate students. You'd be outside, too. So, the South Pole Telescope. Okay. So we're on this journey of making measurements to understand the expansion history of the universe, to understand the birth of the universe, and in understanding how the universe is growing today, we're going after the fate of the universe. Because if the universe is accelerating in its expansion, we're going to end up in a fairly lonely place. Those galaxies and galaxy clusters that we can see today may eventually be pulled out of our reach, and we may not be able to see other galaxies when we look up at the night sky. A long time from now. It's not going to happen soon. Don't worry about yourselves or your grandchildren. We may be in a universe that accelerates and then turns around and collapses and comes into a big crunch. We don't have any observations to support that right now, but there are theories that would have the universe doing this and coming to a big crunch. So really what we're trying to understand when we measure what we're doing today in terms of our expansion, in terms of our expansion history and our size history, is also to understand the fate of the universe and where we're going with it. But why are we going after this? Why is this cosmology so important on a bigger scale, on a scale of all the physics we can do? Well, we know that if we look out, let's say, at the night sky and look at things like galaxy clusters and galaxies, the types of theories and forces we use are gravity. And we talk to people like myself, cosmologists, astronomers. We also know that if we get down to smaller scales, for example, the scales of people and living things, there are completely different forces at work. Here we have to bring up instinct and romance and biology, and naturally we have different experts like psychologists and taxi drivers, biologists and others who know about these living things. And then as we get down to smaller and smaller scales, like molecules, we ask the chemist what's going on, and we look at electromagnetism. When we get down to atoms and subatomic particles, we have different experts, nuclear and particle physicists, and we have different forces that become dominant. When we take these things and put them sort of on our cube of knowledge, we find that if we have something really big, we use Newtonian gravity, which we learned in high school, and it does a good job of calculating the motion of the planets around the sun, you know, for most calculations. If it's moving fast, we use special relativity. We have to ask Einstein what to do, and he figured that out over 100 years ago. And if we get to something really small, we use quantum mechanics. When two of these things, well, the two shown corners are true, we also have figured out what to do. If something is very fast and very heavy, Einstein also gave us general relativity, and we can calculate what we see. If something is very small and moving very fast, like particles in a particle collider, I know what to do. I ask the particle physicist and I use theories like the electroweak theory and the quantum chromodynamics theory. But once I get out here in this corner of this cube of our knowledge, I'm kind of confused. I do not know how to combine quantum mechanics with gravity. I don't have a theory that I can write down and make predictions in this corner. And I have a laboratory where I can test this. If the universe started compact and dense, like a Big Bang model predicts, this is the theory I need to address in that corner of the cube. So part of what we're doing also with cosmology is testing the bounds of our theories, going after observations that tell us about a place in this cube that we don't know exactly which theories to write down or which ones might work. And so that's exciting for me in that it brings together, you know, the particle physicists and the gravity people and so forth and says, hey, you guys have to make a model that explains what we're seeing. And this is one of the only places we have to test it. So let's close this aside and then move forward and back to our image. So we have the microwave background, the same in every direction, and it has spots which gives us a prediction, allows us to explain structure formation in the universe. We can make measurements of this and ask the question, is the universe trying to tell us something? Is there some hidden message in that picture? I'm not sure how that got in. But we need to take the data that we bring back from telescopes and experiments like this and ask these very questions. So what you're looking at here is some of the early data from the South Pole Telescope. This is data of the night sky where we take images of the night sky and we add them together. So we take an image, and then we add another image, and another image, and another image. It doesn't quite work like that. The telescope's actually scanning across here. And this image takes about 4 or 5 months to compile. And what you see on the right-hand side is where we do the same thing, but each second image, we difference. So it's supposed to subtract away anything that's really there in the night sky. And what's left over is sort of the noise, that bit that our experiment wasn't good enough at measuring. Everything you see here is fake and not real, because we've subtracted away by differencing the images. We need to go and look at images like this and try and pull out the galaxy clusters. Can anyone see a galaxy cluster in this image? You need a very trained eye. My computer has a very trained eye. In a different color scale, sorry, the reds have just become greens, here are four very cold spots on the night sky, and it's confusing. We do this to you just to confuse you. We make the cold things red and the hot things blue. That's only to confuse you, I guess. These four cold spots, are these little holes in the sky that I was talking about. The angular size here is about an arc minute, 2 arc minutes or so. And what these are galaxy clusters. We can go with other optical telescopes now that we know where to look and look at the night sky where the South Pole Telescope has told us where to look and see the signs of galaxy clusters. You may not have the trained eye that allows you to see the galaxy clusters in these images. And to be honest with you, I don't either, but I have friends that are optical astronomers, and they can look at these and tell me exactly what we're seeing. And some of the things that we see here, for example, is gravitational lensing, the bending of light from these very massive galaxy clusters that are inside this circle. So these things that are all the same color are galaxy members of the galaxy clusters. These four galaxy clusters are the first thing that we've released, and it's step one in what we're trying to do. They are the first galaxy clusters that have ever been observed with this Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, with holes in the sky. Sorry, the first galaxy clusters that have ever been detected this way. There are other galaxy clusters. If you know where to look, we've been able to build telescopes that are sensitive enough to see them. And our plan, then, is to survey a big region of the night sky, 10% of the night sky, and find all the galaxy clusters that are there, out to any distance, out to any redshift, so that we can start to figure out if these theories of the history of the universe are sound. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the fate of the universe in that we've been measuring how the universe is expanding by looking at these galaxy clusters and see if they fit the model. Let's take just a little detour and talk about the birth of the universe and see if we can't learn something about this bit of time behind this light that we're looking at today. I want to go further. I want to look back not just at this light that was released when chemistry formed, when the energy of the universe was low enough for chemistry to form. I want to look beyond it. And I can't do that with light, because remember, the universe was opaque. What I'm going to do, what I want to see is some telltale sign to see if this model, this Big Bang model that has this inflation, could possibly be correct. And what I want to test is this inflation model that people have come up with, where the universe expands in that first fraction of a second, 10 to the negative 35 seconds after the Big Bang, the universe expands exponentially faster than the speed of light. I like this theory. The community likes this theory. Scientists like this theory because it predicted those spots. And so everyone's attention was drawn to this theory because it made a prediction which was realized in observation. It explains the horizon problem that the temperature or the intensity of light over here knows to be the same as the temperature and intensity of light over there, because before this fast expansion happened, all the universe was in the same place or was very close together and could talk to each other. And finally, it explains that flatness problem. And I'll just give you a cartoon of how that works. I had shown you earlier this plot where no matter how you start, if you have an expanding universe, you move further and further away from flatness. It turns out that what happens with inflation is exactly the opposite. If you're standing on a two-dimensional surface like the Earth, just as a cartoon, and I suddenly take this Earth and I inflate it, I grow it exponentially, what happens is the curvature of the surface I'm sitting on becomes difficult or impossible to see on the scales that we're able to observe. And that's what inflation does, is it blows up in that early expansion time. So there are many observations in cosmology that any of our theories have to explain that are viable theories. But these are just an example of three of the questions that inflation answers. And indeed, we don't really have any observational evidence that contradicts inflation. It makes one other prediction. Well, it makes other predictions as well. But it makes one smoking gun prediction that I want to go after. What I'm trying to measure right now is what people refer to as the smoking gun of inflation, because it makes a prediction that very few other models can come close to produce it. If we look back in time, here we are today, and we look back towards the microwave background, which was released 400,000 years after the Big Bang, we see that image that I've been showing you, the spots. And behind that, we get to the Big Bang and inflation. And something was released out of inflation, much as light was released from the surface of last scattering. What was released out of the time of inflation is gravity waves. Large-scale waves of gravity, perturbations of gravity, perturbations of space-time. And those signals from the Big Bang would be carried forward to the place where the microwave background is released, and it would impart this little signal on the microwave background that is a net orientation of the light waves. The light direction, the orientation of the waves, would trace the structure of the gravity waves. And so the prediction of this inflationary model is that if we're able to look at that light and measure not just how bright it is, but the orientation of the light, the polarization of the light, we will see a coherent signal on scales that are so big, that are supercausal, that the only thing that could form them is something that came from a time when the universe was much closer together. So that's what we're going to go after. The experiment that we're building to go after that is called EBEX, and it's sitting right now in a high bay on a NASA balloon launch pad in Fort Sumner, New Mexico. We're putting it together now. I'm going to fly down there tomorrow and help to install the camera and the rest of the electronics for this telescope. It has a much smaller mirror, a much smaller dish than the South Pole telescope, because we're looking for big structures in the night sky, big scales. But instead of measuring the intensity that I've been showing you over and over again, how much light there is, we're going to try and measure the orientation of that light. So it's very different camera and detectors that are inside it. It's going to fly aboard a NASA helium balloon. So this is a photo of one of these projects launching. This is a launch truck, a payload. For us, this will be our telescope. And this is a balloon that's full of helium. As this balloon rises up, the helium will expand because the air pressure around it is smaller and smaller. And this will grow to be about the size of a football field, this balloon. And it'll be much lighter than air. So it's going to bounce on top of the atmosphere. It's going to float above our atmosphere and essentially almost be in orbit, above all this terrible atmosphere that absorbs the light I want to look at. As it's floating around up there, our telescope is going to make measurements of the night sky, trying to detect this signal, this leftover signal from the Big Bang. This is a collaboration of about 8 or 9 institutions, mostly from the United States, us here in Canada, and also collaborators in France and Italy. And I'll just show you a few pictures from the last few days. People like to have fun in the high bay. This is where we are assembling the whole thing. This is the innards of the camera. The camera itself is this big blue thing here. There's all sorts of cryogenics, refrigeration techniques that allow our temperatures to drop to very low temperatures so they can be very sensitive. A little bit more of the technology that's inside the telescope. This is the focal plane, the detectors that are looking out at the night sky, a big lens above it. A graduate student, Hannes, working on the focal plane. And then the electronics that were built here at McGill University that operates this camera, that allows us to make the measurements of the night sky with these detectors, which are actually built at UC Berkeley. I really want to emphasize how important these teams of people are that are working on these projects. People like the graduate students, Kevin McDermott and Francois Aubin, where is he? Hiding? Oh. Down here from McGill University, and all these other great people from other universities and research institutes, and how these instruments are brought together not just by scientists who have been doing it for decades or more, but by brand new fresh minds who are the up-and-coming science and technology people that are going to be doing new things across Canada and elsewhere. driving not just scientific experiments like this, but other parts of our knowledge-based economy. And of course, we have a strong crew of testers who make sure that you can't break anything. Yes. Okay, so I've taken you on a little bit of an adventure down to the South Pole to look up at the night sky to measure galaxy clusters and use them to trace the expansion history of the universe, hoping to learn about how our universe is growing and extrapolate forward as to where we're going with this accelerated expansion. I've told you a little bit, too, about how we might be able to look beyond this microwave background and look beyond 300,000 years after the Big Bang into what happened before by looking first with light and then the signal imparted on light by gravity waves. And this is something no one's done yet. We aren't anywhere, we are now getting close to being able to make those measurements, but that's entirely new. And shared a little bit of the excitement of this science. So I think I should end here and then take some questions.
Thanks, Matt. And I'll ask people if they would write questions down, and we'll Catherine and other people will collect them, and then I'll ask them. And while we're doing that, I have a wonderful gift for Matt. Wonderful bag.
Thank you, Martin.
Okay. I think I know what it is.
Martin says he thinks he knows what it is.
Yeah, I know what it is.
It was a beer mug. How appropriate. Thank you.
Remind everybody, I'm not supposed to read the notes that were told for me to say. Okay. Please write legibly. And don't forget to complete the evaluation forms at the end. I should mention that next week's lecture, so we're going to, from zooming from neutron stars to the origin of the universe, we're going to go somewhere in between with Professor Tracy Webb, who's going to talk about island universes, the nature and origin of galaxies. And we have some questions. Okay. Oh. Not everyone was listening carefully about this writing legibly thing. Okay, this is an interesting one, Matt. So what type of detectors are used in the South Pole Telescope?
That's a good one. Okay. The detectors that measure light in the South Pole Telescope are called bolometers. These are devices that have an absorber, so it's basically just a piece of metal. It happens to be a piece of metal that's shaped like a spider web. So think of this spider web-like structure as just a big blank piece of metal. This spider web is suspended above a bath, above an object that's at a fixed temperature. A temperature of a quarter degree Kelvin. And though you can't really see it in this image, it's like a bridge. It is a web that's suspended above it. It's not touching it, except on the edges of the legs. When the light comes in, the light is absorbed by that metal, and it heats up the metal a little bit. When the temperature of the metal changes, so the temperature of the metal will then be proportional to the number of photons, or the total energy of the photons that are absorbed there. That is sensed by a tiny thermometer that's located at the center of this bolometer. And the current that goes through that sensor is proportional essentially to the temperature of the power that's landing on the detector. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's essentially what's going on. So we take the light that hits the detector, that hits this piece of metal, and we just convert it to heat, and then we measure the heat that's there. One of the reasons we do that, we don't do coherent detection like you do with radio waves, where you actually see the light wave. You see it as an electrical signal. Because when you do that, you're subject to the laws of, in the laws of quantum mechanics, if you try to simultaneously know the amplitude and the phase of the wave and amplify it, you add noise. You add fake bad signal that isn't really there. So we erase part of that information and just measure the total intensity of the light this way.
We've got a lot of good questions here, Matt. Okay, so you use the phrase faster than the speed of light twice. What's up, man? What are you doing with that?
Okay. The speed limit of light kind of applies. Mostly applies. Okay, we're not allowed to break the speed limit of light. And in fact, I invoked the speed limit of light when I talked about the horizon problem. I said, how can this part of the universe talk to that part of the universe if it's restricted to the speed limit, to light speed to communicate information? And then I talked about inflation, and I said the universe expanded exponentially faster than the speed of light. And naturally, that upset some people, and it should. It should. Well, it doesn't say they're upset, but it should upset some people. The key is that I'm doing that for a tiny, tiny fraction of a second. I'm doing it for a very, very short time. Okay, I'm doing it for 10 to the negative 35 seconds. And I'm allowed through Heisenberg's uncertainty principle to violate those laws through quantum uncertainty for that short bit of time. So I have to do that faster than the speed of light in a very awkward way. And the place where I'm able to be awkward like that is very early on in the history of the universe, where I have a lot of energy density in a very short time. So there's actually no violation of the laws of physics in doing that. It's not a science fiction thing.
Okay. Here's another good one. Tell us what's going on with where this initial energy came from that went, you know, kaboom.
I can't answer that question. And so one of the reasons people really dislike... So, of course, there are people, especially amongst the theorists, that are advocating this model that I've been talking about called inflation. And there are other theorists that advocate other models. For example, there are models of the universe where the universe goes like this and never actually gets to a point, a singularity, a Big Bang. And one of the reasons that people like these models is that they never get to the point where you have a before. Is this the question here?
Yeah.
Where you have a before or the initial energy. One of the things about inflation, though, is eventually you get to the point where the amount of energy that's concentrated into one area is what's called the Planck energy. The Planck energy is the scale at which quantum mechanics completely dominates and everything becomes random, if you like, or unpredictable. Some people like to invoke that because it takes us at the birth of the universe back to a time before which we're allowed to apply the laws of physics and view that as a plus. Some people hate that and say, I never want to go there until I have a theory that can do it. I don't have an opinion about this at all. But I have a prediction from the models that want to go there. And the prediction is that there's going to be these gravity waves that give this large-scale polarization that we're trying to measure with this balloon-based telescope. If we don't see it, it could be that model is entirely wrong, and maybe we should be going down the road of the models that avoid going there at all. Or maybe some clever string theorist or other type of theorist is going to come up with a model or a theory that allows us to do physics at those energy scales.
Okay, here's a couple of practical questions, Matt. Can the balloon, this big balloon you're going to float in the sky, are you going to be able to recover your telescope, or is it just going to drop somewhere? And to what extent is, you mentioned the precision of the South Pole telescope in putting it together, but it's obviously a place where there's extremes of cold, and I guess there's snow and things like that. How do you account for that, and how does it affect your observations?
Okay, let's talk about the first one first, the balloon that we fly. So we're first going to fly the balloon. Our plan is to fly it next month, and it's a test flight that's going to last about a day. We're allowed to overfly Texas, where we're going to launch from. And as soon as we get to the border of any other state, we have to bring it down. So the telescope payload itself is equipped with a parachute and the ability essentially to tear open the balloon, releasing the helium and bringing the payload down. What is supposed to happen is that we tear open the balloon, the telescope starts to fall, the the parachute comes out and it floats gently down to the ground, and NASA provides a plane that follows it, and we see where it lands and we recover it. That's what usually is supposed to happen. Other people have built telescopes that fly in balloons. In particular, a group both here in Canada and the States and elsewhere built a telescope called BLAST, which flew 2 years ago now. And it flew around Antarctica, where we eventually would like to fly our telescope for its second science flight. And it did exactly all of that. It flew around for a while. It made fantastic, beautiful images at a different wavelength, going after different science. And then they tore open the balloon. It fell to the ground. The parachute came out, and it landed on the ice. And then there's a mechanism that's supposed to release the parachute so that it doesn't get dragged. But that part didn't work. So it was drug across Antarctica, essentially. It was drug for about 250 kilometers until eventually it crossed a crevasse and fell in the crevasse. So there's a little bit of risk involved. We may not be able to recover our telescope, but we certainly hope to recover it after our test flight so we can go and make our scientific flight a year later. If not, we will build again. Do you want me to do the second half of this?
Oh, sorry.
To what extent is the South Pole Telescope subjected to wind and or snow, and how does that affect the observations? So building anything at the South Pole, where the typical summer temperature is around minus 30, minus 40 Celsius, and the typical winter temperature is around minus 80, minus 70, minus 80 Celsius, is challenging. It's very challenging, especially if you're trying to build a precision device. So, for example, in the summer, when the sun is just above the horizon, the highest it ever gets is 23 degrees, balmy hot summer day at minus 30, the sun heats one side of the telescope more than the other, and the whole thing deforms. And the place where we're pointing on the sky shifts and looks at a different point in the sky. And we have to track and measure all of that all the time. So that's a challenge. We have to account for the thermal deformation of the telescope itself. And inside the arms of the telescope, we have lasers that are reflecting off mirrors, and we're measuring slight shifts in that reflected light. We have sensors all over the telescope that tell us where it is and where it's pointing. And we have very, very intelligent graduate students who spend their lives taking all this data and figuring out where we were really looking on the night sky based on what they're saying. Then there's also the challenge of the cold. If we lose power inside the cabin for too long and our electronics freeze, we're not sure that they can withstand temperatures of minus 80 Celsius. So there's also the challenge of making sure that we always have power and heat inside the telescope to make sure that we don't ruin our electronics and our detectors.
Okay, here's another. There are a lot of interesting questions here, actually. Does the existence of dark energy, especially described in such an ad hoc way, how does that fit in well with the Big Bang theory when you sort of say, there's this Big Bang, but here's something that's 65% of everything, we'll just fit her in there? I think that's the sense of the question.
Okay, so one of the reasons that dark energy is so mysterious is that the way it works in our theories is that the energy density, the amount of energy per volume of dark energy, is constant. The amount of matter and other energy in the universe isn't constant in density, it's constant in the universe. So as the universe expands, that energy gets distributed across a larger volume. And eventually the universe expands enough that dark energy is visible below everything else. It turns out that for the amount of dark energy we've measured and the way we've measured the universe expanding, dark energy has only just become visible. Only just, in the last half of the history of the universe. It's only now becoming important, and it had no relevance in the birth of the universe, inflation, and so forth. Just now it's becoming relevant. Just now we're seeing it. Does that bother you? Yeah, it bothers me too, and it bothers most scientists that are studying and investigating this. Why now? Why is this dark energy just becoming dominant? I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't know of any theory that can provide you with a good answer to that question. That's one of the reasons why I want to track it down and figure out what's going on. But no, it doesn't contradict the Big Bang model at all. In fact, it goes away in the early universe. It's not observable in the early universe.
Okay. There are several questions saying, please explain where the infinite universe fits in with expansion. Are there other universes, or is this the only one? Does inflation have anything to do with parallel universes? What about all that?
Okay. These are much harder questions, and they're actually questions as an observational cosmologist that I don't have much of a handle on. In other words, I have no measurements, observations, or experiments that I know of that say anything at all about parallel or other universes, or anything at all about the universe at energy scales larger than the Planck energy. That in itself, though, is very interesting. For example, one of the things we look for, the people who made the measurements with a WMAP satellite that was in the lower right-hand corner, the spots, one of the things people look for is colliding universes, some other universe just coming into view for our own. And what that would have done to that image is it would have put a big circle there. The interface of two spheres is a circle on the sky, and we would have seen the change in temperature from some other universe coming in. If there was another universe that was born through a Big Bang, and it was born at a different time from ours, it was born a billion years later, a billion years earlier, the average temperature of that universe would be different from our own. Or could, you know, there's no reason it should be the same temperature. If it was born from the same physics as our own, it would be at a different temperature. And so if that other universe, that parallel or that other universe is just coming into view, we could have seen it in that image, that red PowerPoint image as well. So I'm not claiming to have any information that excludes the possibility of other universes. You can always create a model that has another universe that's so far away I don't get to see it yet. Okay? You have tremendous freedom in inventing theories that make no predictions. Okay? And I can't tell you anything's wrong with that. So I don't get to tell you very much about parallel or other universes except that of all the people who built models like that in the past that made predictions that are now measurable, we haven't seen anything that really supports those models. Doesn't mean they aren't there. I'll be very famous if I'm the one to see it.
Could you explain again the dark ages section in your universe chart, like why you can't see anything there?
Okay. I think it's right back here. So I borrowed this image from NASA's publicity machine because they make fantastic images. But I didn't PowerPoint out or doctor out all of the information here, and yet I didn't explain it all. So the question is about this time called the Dark Ages. So imagine that you have this really highly dense thing, which we'll just call the universe, and it's full of matter, and it's full of dark energy, but you can't see it yet because the other things are dominant. And we expand it out, where the universe is totally uniform, except for those little tiny spots. As we expand far and far and far enough, especially after light is no longer dominant, we have time for those parts that have extra matter collapse together under the force of gravity. We have time to form structure, and eventually the energy that we get from the gravitational potential energy that we can collect in one place is enough to ignite the stars and start the stars burning. The first stars 400 million years after the Big Bang or so. In between this place where the light is released and the first stars start to shine is what's called the Dark Ages. There's matter out there. It's collapsing into structures, but it isn't yet shining. And that's the Dark Ages. And that's where it's going to be very, very hard to make measurements because there isn't really light being emitted, and the matter isn't yet clumped enough, dense enough, collapsed enough that we'll be able to see perturbations in this microwave sky.
This is a question I got a lot, actually, myself in the fall. So at CERN, aren't they building a device to recreate some of the conditions of the Big Bang? And should we be worried?
So CERN is the European Laboratory for Particle Physics. It's located in near Geneva, and it's a great big particle accelerator that sits about 30 meters below the ground. It's great big, like many tens of kilometers around, and that's actually where I did my graduate work. What they are doing inside this tunnel is they're smashing together protons, and they're smashing them together at the highest energies we've ever come close to achieving with man-made devices. So they're going to smash together at energies something like a TV. Okay, and a TV is, what's a TV again?
It's a T followed by a D and a T.
10 to the...
1,000
GB, so 1,000 GB. Okay, so, so we are at 10 to the 12 electron volts. Okay, and this is a very, very high energy, something we've never, we haven't gotten to yet with any sort of man-made device. So many people refer to it as creating conditions like the Big Bang. And that's kind of true, but the energy scales that we're talking about, for example, in inflation to create these gravity waves is more like 10 to the 16 GeV. So it's something like 12 orders of magnitude higher in energy. So we are, with a device like the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, we are approaching these high energies where we get to test theories in ways that they've never been tested before. And in that way, it's, you know, approaching the energies like the Big Bang. But we're still many, many, many orders of magnitude off from being able to reach the energy of a Big Bang. And that's probably a good thing.
And now there's only time for one last question, which is mine. Often these experiments, there's a stage in which you have a proof of principle, but then there's a certain amount of, like you see, there's a cluster of galaxies, but a certain time scale, you know, in graduate student lifetimes before you can definitively say what's going on and did you really see the early universe and you really... So what's the time scale in which the experiment is going to run on the South Pole Telescope? When do you expect to have some... besides the proof of principle that it works?
Yeah. So I would say right now we're in the stage of the proof of principle and that we are releasing publications showing that we are seeing these galaxy clusters on the night sky. We can do what we said we would be able to do in terms of basic measurements, but we haven't yet collected enough data, we haven't collected enough galaxy clusters to go out and measure cosmology yet, to say this model of how the universe formed is a good one and that one fails. The timescale for that is probably about a year from now when the first results that are relevant come out, and it'll probably go on for about two and a half more years. After that, we have plans for the next thing for this telescope, and we intend to be replacing the camera in that telescope with a polarization-sensitive camera as well. So we are going to get our science out from this type of measurement on the scale that we can build something different.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, on that, I'd like to thank everybody and for your informative questions. We'll see you guys next week, same bat time, same bat channel. Thank you again. Let's thank Matt again for a very nice talk.